Hello everyone and welcome to the new edition of My Inspiration, a podcast series from HMV in which we give musicians, actors, filmmakers and producers the chance to take a welcome break from talking about themselves and instead talk about their greatest inspiration. I'm your host Tom Goodman and I'm delighted to welcome you to our latest episode. Our guest today is Aimee McDonald, the Scottish singer-songwriter who has just released her new album The Human Demands. With career sales of over 12 million and a massive loyal following, McDonald has established herself on both these shores and across the world as one of Britain's biggest exports. The Human Demands is her fifth studio album, produced by Jim Abyss, who helped the Arctic Monkeys and Kasabian make their debut records. It's a raw, powerful and dynamic collection of songs, all in McDonald's signature style. The album is out now and we're delighted to welcome her to the podcast to discuss its creation and her greatest inspiration.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. How's the promo trail going thus far, right?
It is a bit different than what I'm used to. I'm obviously used to traveling all over the place and doing interviews, but I'm just sat in my dining room, so strange times.
Yeah, does that mean they're firing more stuff at you because you just got no excuse with no traveling, or is it?
So far, it's been okay, but I don't think we've hit the real nitty gritty yet, so I'll get back to you in a couple of weeks.
All right. So when, obviously, you had the greatest hits, which for a lot of artists, that's very much seen as the kind of end of one chapter. Is that kind of how it felt for you?
Probably yes, because I actually changed labels after that. And I never had that intention when I put out that collection album, but it just kind of happened. And I got offered a contract with BMG. And it just felt like, do you know what? It's probably the right time to go somewhere different. It had been, 2006 is when I signed at Universal. And I just felt like I needed something fresh. I felt like I'd put music out and we would just tick a box and do everything that came with it. And I feel like now, having changed labels, it feels more exciting again. It feels like being back at the beginning and having new people around and doing things a bit differently. And it kind of feels like that's what I needed to do. I needed to kind of freshen things up. So I'm glad that I've done that. And it definitely feels like a new chapter now. I definitely feel a little bit older and wiser.
How has it been kind of setting things up then? Because obviously when you've done a number of records with a label, you sort of know the routines and, you know, getting used to new things. How has that all been? Has it been fun or has it been challenging?
It's actually been great. Obviously we're in the backdrop of these unprecedented times, so it's hard to judge anything based on normal standards, but everybody's been great and it's been really lovely, just kind of feeling like everything's fresh again and that everybody's really excited and everybody's got these new ideas and stuff, and it feels good. It feels like I'm part of a really good and exciting team who want to do really well.
And this new record, I mean, when was it written? Was it kind of written in intense bursts or over a long period of time?
Started writing it in 2018, so I was still very much on the kind of live trail throughout that year. Took time in between to write some songs and then continued on with it 2019. Probably had it all finished by the end of summer last year. And then took a while to get it recorded because of changing labels and all of that stuff in between. And then obviously the recording process was halted down the middle by the lockdown as well. So it's been a bit of a disjointed record. It will certainly be a memorable one for me for a long time because of everything that's happened in between, but hopefully for other reasons as well. Hopefully when people finally hear it, they do like it. And then it has some good memories for me that way as well.
You did the record with Jim Abyss, who, back in sort of 2006, 2007, it felt like he was producing every record, but he's a little more selective now. When did you kind of get together, as it were?
We got together for the first time, it would have been towards the end of last year. I met Jim just in my management's offices in London, and I really liked him. And when I was young, when I was grown up, when I was getting into music, like you say, Jim was producing all the records I was listening to. So I knew of him already from my teenage years. So the thought of having him produce my record was amazing for me. And we done a little test session in a studio in Edinburgh, done two tracks. and just clicked and got on really, really well, worked very well together, and decided, yep, this is who I want to record this album. I think this is a perfect fit. And I think now it really genuinely was a perfect fit. Like, despite everything that's gone on and everything that's happened in the recording process, I genuinely have some of the best memories of being in the studio. Not only did I make a record that I'm so insanely proud of, I just have incredible memories of fun times and all the great kind of joy that I got out of making the record. I have so many happy memories.
When I used to interview bands back then, they used to, when they'd spoke about him, they'd say he works you very hard. I don't know if he's mellowed, but
I didn't feel that Jim worked me particularly hard. He definitely works you hard when he's trying to get the perfect take out of you. So I used to just take the piss out of him, because he would go, right, do it one more time. And I'd be like, Jim, it's never one more time, so stop saying one more. So we had a bit of a joke about that. But he's just a perfectionist. He just wants everything that he does to be perfect. And I think when you've got somebody making your record and them at the helm of everything, then that is a good quality to have. You want somebody that's not going to leave any stones unturned, that they're going to try everything and find the best possible way of working.
And what kind of record do you think it is lyrically? I mean, do you think there's a theme, or is it kind of a bit more like a little collection of islands when it comes to lyrics?
I wasn't intentionally trying to have any sort of theme or any sort of message, but I think that now when I listen back to the album from start to finish, it definitely explores just getting older in life. And I know that I'm not old by any stretch of the imagination, but I think when you hit 30, when you get married, when your friends kind of start to move in different groups because people are having kids or they're moving away, I think you start to evaluate your life a little bit more, and I certainly did. And a lot of these songs, I wasn't trying to sound a particular way or write a song about a certain thing. It just kind of fell into place. And I think that's just me daydreaming, thinking about life, thinking about what would be different had I done something differently. And I think as I've got older, that's something I do more and more, especially with my career, because you always wonder if things would have went a different road had you have done something differently. And it's always something that I do think about.
And when did you kind of decide that The Human Demands was the right fit for the title? I mean, do you kick titles around? I mean, where do they kind of tend to come from?
I do. I always have a list of different titles. Sometimes I think of things that I've got no connection to the songs, or a lot of the time I think about a song. And originally I kind of had the working title of Young Fire, Old Flame, which is a track on there, because it was quite an interesting title as well. But I think as I listened to the album more and more, it felt like it was about life and about the pressures of life and the demands that we put upon ourselves, and feeling that we constantly have to be 100 miles an hour. We always have to have a smile on our face. And I think especially because I've had a few friends that have struggled with their mental health in recent years, friends that have confided in me. And I wrote a song like The Human Demands about that, about those friends and about the struggles that they face and how they feel in their everyday life. And I just thought that that was probably the perfect name for the album, because these everyday struggles are something that we all go through. And yes, they might impact certain people way more than others, but I think that it's important that we're now at a point where it's okay to talk about it, and it should be encouraged, and we should all realise that we all have these anxieties and we have these worries, and it's okay. It's okay to feel a bit shit and to not feel like you're up for something. And that's, I think, essentially the whole message of the album. So that's why I went with that song title as a lead track.
Now, obviously, normally you'd probably be looking at a year, 18 months worth of solid touring. I mean, how much have you kind of got planned in? Anything, nothing? I mean, are you crossing your fingers some dates in next year?
We've put out a kind of a first kind of little foray of dates for the end of April, May next year. And it's just anybody's guess, really. I'm very hopeful. I think that we'll end up going crazy if we're not back to some sort of normal by then. So I'm hopeful that they can go ahead. Obviously, we've got all the precautions in place, if we have to change it, but I'm very hopeful. And I've actually been really, really surprised the amount of people that are excited for gigs and the amount of people that are pre-ordering tickets and that say they can't wait to be there. And I just think, I really hope and dream that we will get to spring next year and we'll be in a place where we can go back to doing the gigging. I think that I'll be really grateful for it. I'll never moan about an early start or a long bus journey ever again.
Yeah, I mean, because obviously you, traditionally, certainly, you've toured very hard.
Yeah, I mean, I have always done a lot of shows, and as my career's progressed, it's something I've done more and more and more of. I think that's a good thing about being around for so long. I think you get good gig offers because people know that you can perform. So I hope that I can go back to that, because it's probably the best part of what I do. It's where everything comes together when you're on stage with an audience and a great band, and that's the part that I love most. So I'm really hopeful that we can fully get back to that.
And kind of until then, I mean, obviously you've got a record to promote, but I mean, are you going to try and keep writing, or are you just going to take some time?
I have purposely decided not to write so much, because I find that I write about how I feel and about my surroundings, and I don't want to get to 2 years down the line with a new album that's just reminding me of this shit. So purposely, I don't think anybody wants reminded of it. And I think that there will be an influx next year of Corona albums, and I just, nobody needs that. Nobody needs another one.
Yeah, there are going to be a lot of Zoom call references, I think, on records.
Oh, gosh.
Well, we got you on today to talk, as the record, about your inspiration. So do you want to tell us who you've picked?
Yes, the inspiration that I have picked is the Scottish band Travis. They have been probably the pivotal inspiration for me. They were the band that inspired me to teach myself to play guitar. So without them, I might not be here doing my thing right now.
So how did you first discover them? I mean, did you hear them on the radio, see them on TV? Where was it?
I heard them on the radio. I had a radio cassette player thing that I would always take into the bath with me, and I would just kind of lay in the bath for hours, and I'd put the radio on, and I put on the local station here in Glasgow, and I heard Why Does It Always Rain On Me, and I was just like, what is that song? It's absolutely brilliant. And this was obviously before phones and you can quickly look things up, so I remember I had to listen like intently for the DJ to tell me what the band was. When he said it was Travis, I was like, I need to buy this album. So I bought I waited till I saved up money that my nana had given me, and I bought the album The Man Who a couple of weeks after I heard that first song.
And how did that kind of compare to the stuff you were listening to otherwise? Was it in a sea of pop, or were you sort of listening to similar things anyway?
I was probably listening to similar things. I remember the Christmas previously, my Christmas list was just loads of music and albums. And I remember getting the Ocean Colour Scene Greatest Hits, and I absolutely loved Ocean Colour Scene. So they were something that I listened to a lot of at that point. So Travis was probably in a similar style vein anyway.
Yeah. How did that kind of compare to what your friends were listening to?
I was always definitely the odd one out. My friends at that point were all very much pop, radio friendly, whatever. That's what they listened to. And I remember when I started at high school, I was definitely like completely different. And me and another girl bonded at PE class because I had a Travis t-shirt on, and she had a Kings of Leon t-shirt on, and we realized, oh, we both like kind of guitar music, and she's now still one of my best friends to this day. So that's what was good about going to high school. You connect with other people that have similar tastes.
So having heard that track and got the album, I mean, I read that you also then bought a Travis chord book. I mean, how easy were the songs to learn?
They're okay, actually. I think that I've probably just followed in that vein. They're quite easy for novices to teach themselves. So that's what I'd done. The first song that I was able to play was a track Turn from that album. And when I could finally get it, that I could get the chords changing in time with Fran Healy singing, I was so proud of myself. Like, I don't think I've ever been prouder of that moment.
And then when did that translate into writing your own songs? I mean, was it soon afterwards? Did it take a while?
It took a little while. I continued on just kind of learning old Travis songs. I then went back the way they had a previous album, so I bought that one as well, Good Feeling, and learned everything on that. And then it was maybe a year or so, I started writing my own songs on the guitar, started exploring what I could come up with myself.
What are those early songs like? I mean, do they sound like Travis?
They're probably not good enough to sound like that. There was one called The Wall, nothing like Pink Floyd's The Wall, and it was based around my sister. She absolutely loved the Red Hot Chili Peppers and the actor Ewan McGregor. And I would sit in her bedroom because she had a double bed and I had loads of space to get my notebook out and all of that. And I'd sit and just look at all the posters on her wall. And that's where that inspiration of that song came from. It was about that somebody like my sister can be so impacted by these people, but they don't even know she existed. So I was quite deep for a young person.
What do you think it was about Travis that particularly connected with you back then? I mean, do you think it was the lyrics or just the kind of size of the choruses? I mean, what do you think it was?
I think it was just everything. Just the Travis were just so melodic. Like the Fran Healy just had such a wonderful voice as well. And the lyrics, they just kind of felt like they meant something to me. Like, I know it's easy to say, oh, why does it always rain on me? You're from Scotland, that's going to happen. But I'd never really heard anything like that at that point. And then being able to get the album and discover all the tracks, I just, songs like Driftwood, they kind of really spoke to me. It felt like it was a part of me. And even now, like when I hear songs like that, I just think back with a massive smile on my face, just all the happy memories I have from them albums.
I mean, having grown up at a similar time, what was certainly a period of that feature was bands who were sort of pretending to sing in American accents. And Travis were definitely unapologetically Scottish. Do you think that was a part of the connection as well?
I think it probably was, because it felt like it was much closer to me. It felt like, especially when I started to write my own songs as well, having an inspiration like Travis, who came from similar areas to me, whose life wasn't too dissimilar to me. When you see people like that having the successful career, it does make you go, well, if they can do it, maybe I can do it as well. And I definitely think I had that connection because of that. But also the times where I saw them live, I found Fran Healy as a frontman, he was so captivating. Like, it wasn't just about the songs, it was about the stories and everything in between. And I found myself going away from shows feeling like, oh, wow, as if I had a real kind of solid connection, not just to the music, but to the people.
Do you think he taught you like how to be kind of a live performer and how to keep, especially it's just you who've got to captivate an audience, you know?
It did 100%, right from the very start. I was somebody that loved going to gigs. I always have loved going to gigs, and I've watched a wide variety of different artists from all over. And the thing that I always loved was the banter with the performer and the audience. I just loved that, because you felt like you were important. You didn't just feel like another stop along the way of a tour. You felt like you were part of the show. So from the very beginning, I've channeled that. I've definitely got my live performer persona via Fran Healy, and would happily say that 100 times. Just he as a performer, he knows how to do it, and that's the route that I've always followed, and it's really worked well for me. I get so many amazing fans giving me great feedback, saying that they absolutely love all of that side of the concert as well. It's not just about the music, it's about chatting and feeling that you're all together. And I've had to do it, like, because I spend a lot of my time performing in Europe, the accent can sometimes be tricky, but even in Germany, Switzerland, they get it, and they want to hear the monologues between the songs, and it's quite nice that people appreciate that side of it as well.
Obviously, the time you're discovering Travis is definitely peak Travis. That's when they were Inescapable and pretty much the biggest band in Britain. Obviously, there's been a lot more after that, which has sort of had less fanfare. What do you make of kind of later period Travis?
I think Travis have always produced great melodic kind of pop rock music that I think there's always going to be a place for it. I think the the difference as taste change and radio changes and streaming comes in. And it makes it more difficult for older established artists like Travis to get that breakthrough because people don't have the same excitement and buzz that they want for a new artist. It's always about new. And it's always about stuff that fits the current trends. Now, a band like Travis have never tried to fit into trends. So many pop rock bands, whatever we want to call them, indie rock, they've never tried to fit into a trend, and that's maybe detrimental in terms of getting radio play, getting streaming support. But I think ultimately, as a performer, as an artist, it sits better knowing that you'd done something because you loved it and because you felt proud of it and you were passionate about it, rather than you're just trying to get play, you're just trying to fit into a certain niche. I prefer when bands and artists just, they do what they do and that's it, and they don't try and change it just to fit in anywhere.
It's interesting because obviously, like, when you're an artist, your approach to think of things as getting bigger, you know, you start on small stage, you keep going and you stay there. Obviously they went supernova, and then I've sort of had to navigate a path after that where you're not flavor of the month. It must be difficult for an artist, that, I think. Or do you just sort of take the buzz of live performing?
I think it definitely would be difficult. I think that, I mean, there's times I've done big stages and then went back and played smaller venues and stuff. But I think that ultimately, if you focus mainly on that, then you're always just going to be unhappy, and you're going to put all your happiness on what support you've got at radio or what support you've got at streaming and stuff like that. And really, anybody that knows the music industry knows that it's pointless, because you can never always be flavor of the month. And sometimes I think when people have that rapid rise to the top, it's too much. It would be better to slowly and steady do it bit by bit, because it's always the way. People are fickle, particularly in the UK with music. We always want something new and something different, and they'll like you 1 minute and then they won't the next, and there's nothing you could do about that. I mean, you could be a band like Travis and you could write the next Bohemian Rhapsody, but if nobody plays it on the radio and the streaming people don't give you any playlists, then you're never going to get anywhere with it. So I think you just need to be proud of what you do and try not to analyse every little thing. For me, as long as there's people that want to hear me sing and people that want to listen to my music, that's great. It doesn't matter if it's 10,000 or 500, like, it's still an amazing place to be in, that there are people out there willing to support you.
Yeah. Obviously the thing they haven't done, which lots of bands have done, is, you know, split up for a year, then come back and suddenly your profile can increase exponentially, but not interested, you know?
No, I think they've just constantly just stuck at it, and they do what they do. I mean, they've had an incredible career. They've shifted an unbelievable amount of records. Probably any modern artist would kill to have the career that they have. And they've done it all without kind of shitting on anybody else. They just do their thing, that's it. And they just seem like a really lovely bunch of guys who are incredibly talented. And for me, I feel very grateful that they came along when they did, because without them, like I say, I've never had anything that has grabbed me as much as they did to make me want to teach myself to play the guitar. Like, I love other artists, but I've never had anything that has given me that push that they did.
You haven't got the option, of course. You can't split up with yourself. It's difficult.
I probably could, you know. Sometimes I talk some of it as shite.
So we always ask people kind of, what the undiscovered gem is. What's the kind of bit of the back catalogue that people tend to skip over? I mean, with Travis, some people may have stopped at The Man Who, some people may have stopped at 12 Memories. What's the kind of bit of the catalogue for you that doesn't get the recognition it's deserved?
So one of my friends, like, when we were at school, she had no interest in anything that wasn't, like, super pop music. And Travis bought out their recent record. I can't even remember what time it was, but she was working in a department store at that point. So this song from that record got played loads. And it's the moment she finally clicked and was like, I love this song. I really like Fran Healy's voice. I think I finally like Travis. And it was a song that Fran Healy had written for he'd had a baby, and it was called My Eyes. And it's just such a lovely, melodic, beautiful pop song of a father singing to his child, and I just thought it was absolutely lovely. And even now when I listen to it, I think, what a catchy, great little song that probably if he'd been a new artist at this point, it would have cut through. But because they weren't new, it's like you don't get the same interest in it.
And if anyone was going to start with Travis, you know, what's the place to start for you? Is it The Man Who or is it somewhere else?
Well, obviously, so The Man Who is obviously Travis's second album, but that's where I started. And I think that it's just an absolute classic. I think when you listen to that record now, it still sounds as fresh as it did back then. I don't think it is dated at all. I think that if somebody bought that record out right now, I would absolutely love it and be recommending it to anybody and everyone that would listen. So I would probably just start there. I think that that album done so well for a multitude of reasons, and as soon as you listen to it, you can get it. Travis as well, I mean, they're an amazing live band. Like, a lot of bands have great records and it falls down when they try and perform live, but they have it all. They're an incredible live band as well, and the songs really get the chance to shine when they perform them live as well. So I think just for somebody just starting, I think, yeah, go for The Man Who, and you can't really do much wrong there.
Where did you first see Travis live? How old were you?
I can't remember exactly what age I was, but they headlined Teen the Park. And I begged my mum to take me, which was probably the worst experience of my mum's life. It was amazing for me, though. She took myself, my sister and my school friend at the time. And I just absolutely loved every minute of it. It was absolutely tipping it down with rain the whole day in the mucky field at Bilado. And just being there, hearing them sing Why Does It Always Rain On Me whilst we're all soaked to the skin, it just felt like a real moment. And it was amazing as well. It was amazing having a Scottish band headline Scotland's biggest festival. It felt like a real, real special moment in Scotland's kind of rich musical history.
Yeah, I never got to go to Tea in the Park, but every year it seemed to be drenched, but people loved it.
Oh, yeah. We're used to it up here, so the weather doesn't really impact it, but it was brilliant. Like, it was just, it's such a loss that it isn't there anymore. I think that it would be great to get it back, but I think they'd need to kind of revisit the old kind of booking system where it's all the kind of rock bands and all good guitar music and stuff like that. I think it lost its way a bit like a lot of British festivals. They kind of went too radio friendly and it just kind of lost the magic a little bit.
Yeah, obviously that's been, I mean, you have to wonder what the festival season's going to look like next summer when, you know, there's presumably going to be a lot of hard work to make sure that people can go.
Well, that's the thing, like, because festivals, something like Glastonbury, it's on in June, and then the work for the next festival begins the day that the previous one ends. Like, so you wonder if, I mean, the amount of work that goes into it, especially if they put in all this work and then we get to next summer and they say, oh, it can't go ahead. But I'm hopeful that they can go ahead. I think maybe we just need to put them on sale and hope for the best, Julie, and just have a contingency plan. But I mean, everything that I've seen points to the, well, I really don't know anymore. I hope that the festivals can go ahead next year.
Thank you very much for letting us hear your inspiration, and yeah, good luck with everything for the new record.
Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed today's edition of My Inspiration. If you'd like to check out our previous episodes, which include chats with LaRue, Pet Shop Boys, Luke Evans, Mae Martin, Big Nasty, and many more, you can listen to them all at our website, which is hmv.com/podcast, or on all your regular podcast providers. Next week, our guest will be James Bourne. He is Busted and Son of Dork fame, and he'll be telling us all about his new solo album and his inspiration, pop punk titans Blink-182.